On Monday, we read from your letters. A surprising number of listeners wrote in during our segment on the ritual of asking a father for his daughter's hand in marriage. Turns out the tradition may be faded, but not forgotten. Joe Spencer in St. Paul, Minnesota, offered this story. My father-in-law is deaf, so when I sat down with him to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage, we had our conversation on notepads. This moment is a treasured memory for which we have a treasured memento. Newlywed Stephen G. wrote that he flew from Portland, Oregon to San Jose, California and back in the same day to ask permission to marry his then-girlfriend. Everything was calm until the descent into San Jose Airport, Stephen wrote. Then suddenly, it was terrifying. I didn't really know what I was going to say. When I finally met up with her father, he seemed 2 feet taller than I'd remembered him. I just blurted out in my finest prepubescent cracking voice, "I want to marry your daughter." A bear hug later and a big hearty yes, I was back to the airport and headed back to plan how to pop the question, another nervous story entirely. And Joan Welsh emailed us a scanned copy of a letter her father wrote over 80 years ago. Dated June 17, 1923, in a slanted scrawl it reads, "I am taking this opportunity in writing you and asking your consent to my marrying of your daughter Leonie. I am very sorry in not being able to see you personally on this matter. I decided to teach school this winter, and we thought this would be a fine opportunity to be with each other and to begin our home. Trusting that my request may meet your approval, as it would be the greatest thing to Leonie and myself, for we love each other more than anything else in this world. I remain sincerely yours, Tracy, in Rexbury, Idaho." Joan also sent us a copy of her grandfather's reply. "My dear Mr. Shepherd, I received your request and appreciate the gentlemanly manner in which you have written me concerning Leonie. I don't think you can realize how hard it will be for Mama and myself, as our little girl is very dear to us. I certainly hope that you both will be congenial to each other and work for each other's welfare and happiness. My answer is yes. Yours respectfully, H. Sorensen." We also got a lot of questions for Tony Perrottet about the history of the Olympics, so we've asked him back. Mr. Perrottet is the author of The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games, and he joins us now from his home in New York. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Our first question is from Roz Rogoff in San Ramon, California. "I know women were not allowed to participate in the Olympics," she wrote. "Were they allowed to attend?"
It's a strange situation. Virgin women were allowed to attend, but married women weren't allowed in, even as spectators. You have to understand that the ancient Greek society was a very misogynistic society, so they weren't given any education whatsoever, let alone being allowed into the gymnasiums. And there were two exceptions to this, and the first one was that women had a secondary sort of games called the Festival of Hera, dedicated to the goddess Hera. The other big exception to all this was in Sparta, which was a very militaristic and a strange society from our point of view. The main idea was to raise powerful and muscular warriors. So women were actually trained in athletics so that they could become strong mothers.
Our second question comes from Adi Tobiasen in Redwood City, California. "Did the ancient Greeks use any sort of performance-enhancing drugs for athletic advantage?"
Well, obviously it was a pre-steroids era, but there was a lot of concern about the use of magic. There were various performance-enhancing potions, I guess you could call them, that would improve strength, speed, and agility. And there was a widespread concern that athletes would get involved with these. In fact, the oath at the beginning of the games was to swear that you had spent 10 months training in accordance with the rules of the Olympics, and implicit in this that you'd use nothing to influence your the outcome of the contest by use of magic. Now, the other side of the coin was that black magic was actually used to curse other athletes. And in fact, what people used to do was you would write a curse down on a lead sheet, and it would be rolled up and buried in graveyards so that the dead could take it down to the underworld. Now, that they've found the various versions of these in Athens. They're designed to, say, sap the strength of wrestlers, to make runners trip over, and charioteers to crash and often be killed.
Tony Perrottet, good to see that the spirit of good sportsmanship goes back to the ancient times, too.
Human nature hasn't changed, that's for sure.
Tony Perrottet's book is The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. He joined us from his home in New York. The best way to reach us is on email. The address is totn@npr.org. Please include the topic of the show in the subject line. Tell us the city and state that you're writing from, and if necessary, give us some guidance on how to pronounce your name. Talk of the Nation is produced by Susan Lund, Setsuko Sato, Justine Kennan, Becky Vlamis, and Kara Arsenault. Chad Campbell directs our program. Brendan Banizak assists in producing it, and Martina Castro is our intern. Kevin Wade is the technical director. He gets engineering help from Vince Muse, Sue Klein, Kimberly Jones, and Chris Nelson. Sue Goodwin is our senior producer. Ellen Silva is the senior editor. And Leith Bishop is the executive producer of Talk of the Nation. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.